for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Many people are choosing to use some form of fertility treatment to have babies. The rapidly changing technology has given options to many more couples and singles wanting to become parents. But the technology is moving faster than the law, leaving some families in legal and ethical limbo. Joining me in the studio, Dr. Paul Gindorf of George Washington University Medical Center. Good morning to you, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Kimberly Layton. She's assistant professor of philosophy at American University. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane.
Joining us from NPR West is Richard Vaughn of the National Fertility Law Center. Good morning to you, Richard.
Good morning, Diane.
And from WBUR in Boston, Maureen McBrien of Suffolk County, Suffolk University Law School. Good morning to you, Maureen.
Good morning, Diane.
Glad to have you all with us, and that includes our listeners as well. I hope you'll join us. Questions, comments, call us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Dr. Gindorf, if I could start with you.
Yes.
There are many, many new assisted reproductive technologies around now that maybe weren't here a few years ago. Talk about some of those.
Absolutely. Well, there's a history of in vitro fertilization that's roughly 25 years old. In vitro fertilization simply is taking an egg and a sperm, combining it outside the body, forming a fertilized egg, and transferring it back to the uterus for implantation so a pregnancy can ensue. There's been a great emancipation of women's reproductive rights over the past few decades, starting with contraception, et cetera. And assisted reproductive technology has pretty much kept up and allowed for more improvements in that area. So that if women are delaying in childbearing because of personal choice or career, if they have a choice with contraception or controlling their reproductive function and body, they can now have children whenever they wish, later in life, for example, on their own terms. And these expansions in technology include the following: embryo freezing, egg freezing, sperm freezing, gestational carrier, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, allowing for third-party reproduction.
So who is it who is using these kinds of new technologies?
Any individual can use these technologies.
And many, many people are. Older people as well, even women who've gone beyond the menopausal stage who would like to have a child. Richard Vaughn, what about the laws dealing with all these many technologies? Are we moving, as I said in my introduction, a little faster technically than we are legally?
Well, I think with the advancement of many technologies, the law is typically behind. Right now, what we have in place is really a presumption of law that if you're using a surrogate, for instance, the law would presume that the person giving birth is the mother unless you otherwise rebut that presumption. On the other end of the spectrum is adoption, where there are many statutes in place defining how to proceed in an adoption. But with surrogacy, you're kind of in the middle, and you've got to know what the state law is where the birth occurs and follow those procedures in that state.
And right,
really,
Diane, if
no
I could just add something.
Sure, Maureen.
As the other attorney on the panel here, the law is definitely behind, but it is catching up. And what you see is a trend towards making the intended parents, i.e. those persons or person who sought out the assisted reproduction in the first place, having them being recognized as the legal parents of any resulting children.
Isn't there a case that's coming up challenging the law on these issues, Maureen?
There's various cases. I'm not sure which one you're referring, but there's been various cases throughout the nation that have challenged something has gone wrong within the assisted reproduction scenario, whether it be a surrogate had wanted to keep a child or what have you. And
yeah,
the law, in general, okay, is coming down on the side of the intended parents.
Okay, I was referring to one in particular that deals with Social Security benefits.
Yes, I'm currently involved in litigation involving a woman who conceived a child after her husband's death and through intrauterine insemination and applied for Social Security survivorship benefits on the record of the deceased wage earner, which was her husband. In that instance, the Social Security Administration denied benefits because it does not recognize the legal parent-child relationship between the decedent and the child. Now, in certain states, they've ruled the other way and have recognized the legal child parent-child relationship for a posthumously conceived child and awarded benefits. So you're ending up with different results in each state depending on where the decedent resided.
I see. Now, help me to understand that. You're saying that the deceased husband had frozen sperm?
Yes. He underwent chemotherapy, and prior to doing that, had his sperm cryopreserved on the recommendation of his doctors to preserve his fertility, with the intention being that they would conceive a child hopefully during his lifetime. He and his wife did have discussions, though, and he had said to her, if I do not survive, I consent to your using my sperm posthumously so that I may conceive a child.
I
and she
see.
Did, in fact, do that.
I see. And turning to you, Kimberly Layton, these are very unusual issues, and especially for the children born into these unusual circumstances. What are those issues?
Thanks, Diane. Well, I think there's been a lot of attention that's been focused on this question of the children, and I think sometimes that can take us in a complicated direction because families are always complicated, right? And the ways in which we come into life aren't predictable, and the ways we go out of life aren't predictable. So I think as an ethicist, what I come in wanting to do in this conversation is ask first, well, what ethical values are being raised in the discussion? What norms are we putting forward? And secondly, what arguments are we making based on those norms? So, for instance, I think this is a very interesting case about the posthumously conceived child. And I was thinking about this morning and wondering what would happen if the couple had been engaged in an adoption before the man died and the adoption wasn't finalized until after he died. Would this case, if it recognizes the posthumously conceived child, also be extended, for instance, to non-biological, quote-unquote, children? So I think when we step back and look at a case like this, we ask, as an ethicist, well, what values are important here? And certainly the values of continuity, of relationship, those kinds of things. But I want to be careful that we're not putting too much emphasis in these discussions on the values of genetics alone. And I think that's where it's very important the way that cases have moved to, say, intention or the development of relationship between a person and a child is that which establishes some kind of paternal identity.
Paul Ginloff.
The issue is about family building and fertility or infertility as a disease. It's really about quality of life and what the role of the physician should be in this dialogue with the patient. It's also involving open access for reproductive rights for all individuals, and we should be all inclusive.
Richard Vaughn, I wonder how you weigh in on this legal question of the deceased parent and the right of the child to enjoy benefits from that parent, especially if there is a discussion between the two parents before the father dies.
excuse me, Maureen may be able to answer this a little better, but my reading of the cases on posthumous reproduction basically say that if the deceased parent has given consent to become a parent in the event of death, then that would rule.
Is it as clear-cut as that, Maureen?
Not necessarily. I mean, there is a trend to say that if the decedent consented in a record prior to his death to posthumous conception, that the child will be considered his legally after his death. Whether that child is in fact a child of the decedent, there's two aspects. One, the biological connection is typically undisputed in these cases because of the chain of custody regarding the sperm. But two, there's the legal relationship, and they're somewhat distinct. Whether that child is in fact an heir of the decedent is important not only for Social Security benefits purposes, but also, for example, under intestate administration, whether that child is going to get a share of the decedent's estate.
Sure.
And also, to the extent that the decedent, for example, had a relative and he was going to inherit under that person's estate, that child might, if there's a legal child relationship, might take in his stead if he's deceased. So there's it goes beyond Social Security and biology as well.
I should say, Maureen McBrien, she is a lawyer in private practice in Boston, Massachusetts, author of Assisted Reproductive Technology. We'll take just a short break here. We'll talk about sperm donors' rights when we come back. And welcome back. We're talking about new reproductive technologies and the question as to whether the law has caught up with that area of growth. Here in the studio is Dr. Paul Gindoff. He's professor of OBGYN at the George Washington University Medical Center. He's director of the Fertility and IVF Center at GW Medical Faculty Associates. And Kimberly Layton, she's assistant professor of philosophy at the American University. On the line with us, Richard Vaughn, managing attorney of the National Fertility Law Center, and Maureen McBrien. She's a lawyer at Todd and Weld in Boston, Massachusetts, co-author of a book titled Assisted Reproductive Technology, A Lawyer's Guide to Emerging Law and Science. Let's talk about the laws for sperm donors' rights. Richard Vaughn.
There are about 35 states that have laws regarding sperm donation. There's also an American Bar Association Model Act governing assisted reproductive technology. Both of these, in both of these situations, essentially the donor is considered not to be a parent of a child conceived by means of assisted reproduction.
So what does that mean if, for example, a child, say, of a sperm donor grows to majority and wants to find out who his, her father is?
Well, generally, if a sperm donor has donated through a sperm bank, for instance, or through a licensed IVF clinic and is anonymous, then that anonymity remains. So typically, these children are not able, at least without some other further showing, to find out the identity of their father.
Is that truly anonymity? I mean, what about in the case of a medical question?
Well, this question of a child's right to know, as it's been being called in the ethical debate about gamete donation, has become very heated in the last couple of years. And it has so for a number of reasons that I think are important to look at. And certainly one of them is the growing belief that we need certain kinds of medical information to have a future health and predictable health. But On the one hand, that feels right to us. But on the other hand, much documentation is showing, and research is showing, that genetic information is only a small part of prediction for disease. So many more things contribute to that. So in part, I'm not sure that the practical argument is really the most persuasive here. But it's important to note that many of the people who are arguing for the right to know are arguing that because they think that a child needs a father, not just that a child needs to know. So if one traces this movement, for instance, in the United Kingdom, it can be looked at in terms of how the father's rights movement has developed there. So I think it's very important ethically to parse out these different issues. Yes, there's an issue of knowing, but when we look at these different arguments being made, and as I said, the values being endorsed in them, much of the time it's about having a two-parent heterosexual married family.
The
American Society of Reproductive Medicine has codified four levels of information sharing. Level one is non-identifying information. Level two is non-identifying contact for medical updates only. And this gets to the genetic diseases or future diseases in the sperm donor that could, in fact, be transmitted to offspring. Level three involves non-identifying personal contact. And then level four is indeed identifying with personal contact. And due to changing norms in our society vis-a-vis anonymity in gamete donation, it makes one pause and wonder if we've been too narrow about what we should expect.
What does that mean, being too narrow in terms?
Too narrow in terms of the levels, meaning it's pretty much agreed upon that non-identifying information is a given with or without the medical updates.
But suppose you did say, well, if an individual reaches the age of majority and wants to know about the sperm donor, would you think that fewer donors would show up because they wouldn't want to have responsibility for that young person.
That's possible, but also we have no idea how people would react to that. And there's plenty of people to volunteer for that service.
I see. All right. Kim, you've got a comment.
Well, statistically, from the research I've done, the countries that have moved from anonymity to exclusive non-anonymity have had, in fact, quite a dramatic drop in the number of people who are willing to donate gametes. Yes.
I see.
But on the other hand, I think that for me, the essential issue here is about moral choices. We live in a society that believes in people exercising their right to reproduction in the way that they wish to, considering the levels of harm, et cetera, being done. And my concern about moving quickly from the issue of reproductive technology to law is that I think we want, in this country anyway, to leave open opportunities for people to make different kinds of moral choices about their families. So, in fact, leaving anonymity an option might be the appropriate thing for some people seeking fertility treatment. Seeking a donor who wants to be identified might be a different option that people would want.
Maureen,
and I think those choices are important.
Maureen McBrien, how do you see it?
Sure. I'd like to tell a brief story
sure.
about a case that's relevant to this. There was I believe it was in California, an anonymous sperm donor who donated a sperm through a clinic. And the child resulting from his donation ended up developing polycystic kidney disease, which is an inherited disease. And the parents of that child sued the clinic. And in connection with that litigation, sought the identity of the sperm donor and sought to take his deposition to determine whether he knew, in fact, that he had carried this genetic disease and that the fertility clinic was negligent in not giving that information to the intended parents. And that litigation ended up that the donor did have his deposition taken, but his anonymity was still concealed from the intended parents. There's also another case in Massachusetts where a Boston doctor donated his sperm. Two children resulted. It was an anonymous donation. And then the intended mother ended up being on welfare and asked that his identity be revealed so that she could get child support. So you do have situations cropping up, albeit very rare, in anonymous donor situations. You have more legal liability from a donor perspective if you are known. If you are known to the recipient, you could be considered a legal parent, even if that might not have been your intention initially.
Oh, I see. I see. Well.
And Diane, if I might interrupt.
Sure.
In a known donor situation, you would definitely want to put a contract together that explains the intentions of the parties regarding parental rights, and that would apply whether a sperm donor or an egg donor. And I think it's important, and I do know that a lot of agencies in this business are discussing the issue of anonymity, talking to the donors ahead of time as to whether they would like to be anonymous or if they were able to be known. And you need to ask the intended parents the same question. Do they want a known donor or an anonymous donor?
But in addition to the anonymity question, what kind of rigorous examinations are sperm donors put through before their sperm donation is accepted, Paul Gindorf?
Well, there are regulations that are followed, state and federal laws. In fact, the CDC has involved the FDA in regulating our medical field. The FDA is involved with tissues, blood banking, and any biological fluids and tissues, including sperm and eggs, for example. So sperm donors and egg donors have a vetting process where they have extensive medical review, biological, microbiological, physical examinations, vetting before they're released. Of course, infectious transmittable diseases like HIV, other viruses, syphilis, et cetera, are screened. The specimens are quarantined for a minimum of 6 months before release. The individual is rechecked before release. So it's very well regulated, and the screening process is very, very good.
Okay, so we've talked about sperm donation. Now, what about egg donors and their rights? Richard Vaughn.
Well, the same thing I said before would apply to egg donors. It's important to get a contract in place, especially with egg donation, because there are not any statutes in place defining the rights and responsibilities of egg donors vis-a-vis parents. So getting a contract in place is the most important thing. And by and large, all of these contracts, of course, would leave the intended parents with full parental rights.
With full parental rights. That's very interesting.
Well, and with full access to making any decisions regarding the eggs that are donated and any resulting embryos.
Turning to you, Kim Layton, this question of selecting the egg donor and selecting a sperm donor. How much is that going on these days, and does that get into the area of designing a baby?
Well, I like to think sometimes about the ways in which people now shop for their mates online on Match.com and other kinds of things, and I'm not sure necessarily how different these things get to be. But I think there are many questions that are raised about how we invest in an idea of a child and what that child should be or should become. And we have, I think, as a culture, many fantasies about that. And there's a nice sort of phrase that when people are not using any kind of technology, they sort of consider it the genetic lottery, right? The idea that when whatever a child is, whether you have a religious belief or not, the lottery is what it is. And I think that technology in general seems to offer us some kind of promise of control. And so with all of the uncertainties that can come about in having a child, we do sort of look towards technology and what it makes available to have a greater sense of control. So I think that there are issues to look at about what we expect when we use, say, donor gametes, or when we use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. Do we have greater expectations on a child? That, to me, is the more ethically relevant question than designer versus not, because that the technology is not there yet. And an interesting suggestion someone made at a conference I was at was, well, let's have gamete donation, but let's have it be race blind. And, of course, everyone gasped in the room. What are we investing in about our notions of what a family is, what a family should look like, what a child should look like? To me, one of the most problematic issues about choosing in relationship to technology is choosing gender, that some people want to use, for instance, yes, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis to specify the genitals that a child is born with. And from my perspective as an ethicist, that's probably the most loaded thing, because everything else is going to be fairly accidental. You can pick a sperm donor who's a musician, but the likelihood of your child being a musician is especially if you don't expose them to music, pretty slim.
How often does that question come up for you, Paul?
Almost never.
Never.
No, the patients we're seeing are very reasonable. In terms of donor selection as well, I just wanted to comment that I think there's a misconception here about how particular individuals may be or patients may be. They're very grateful and happy to have a process available to them to family build. And the vetting process is very rigorous, and the number of, let's say, egg donors available is very limited. And there is a process, there is a selection process. Patients are given files to review, et cetera, and a match is made. But everyone seems to be very reasonable about it.
Paul Gindorf, he's professor of OBGYN at the George Washington University Medical Center. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now first to Jefferson City, Missouri. Good morning, Lisa. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
My question, my sister has some mental health issues, and enough that she's actually on full disability now. And 4 years ago, she, unbeknownst to her family, went behind our backs and got loans from three banks and I think a credit card advance, and was able to do in vitro. And we were all pretty horrified, because she's a hoarder and her house was a wreck and not fit for a child to live in. And we've been working with her, and she's not a danger to my niece or anything, and my niece is thriving. But it just brings to mind, are there any kind of screenings for mental health in this, with these technologies? You know, she's doing okay and she's got a lot of support, but we never thought she would have a child, and we never thought she should. And we've moved her out of her apartment. Actually, she lived with my dad for the first 4 years of my niece's life, and she just recently purchased the house again behind our backs without our knowledge.
Interesting. Paul Gindorf, what kinds of tests are made when the individual comes in?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. I mean, the caller is really referring to screening for the mother of the child.
Exactly.
Which is, very judgmental, and I think that it's not our place to decide who's fit to be a parent. quite frankly, from a social, psychological context point of view.
Do you agree with that?
Well, I think, you know, within reason, you have to be pretty open-minded about that without making too many comments about how families are remaining intact, et cetera, in our society today. When you look at donors, however, that's a process that's very well controlled and organized in terms of psychological screening, because here we're very interested in whether or not there'll be any fallout emotionally on the donor giving up an egg or a sperm and then not knowing anything about the results of that, whether a child is born, whether they're a parent or not, etc.
Okay, we'll come back to that question and your reaction, Kimberly Layton, after we take just a short break. Perhaps our other guests may have some reactions as well.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at Hewlett.org. This is NPR.
Neuroscientist Susan Berry was cross-eyed since infancy, unable to see in three dimensions.
The snow would appear to fall in one flat sheet. I did not feel like I was part of the snowfall, but I was looking in on the snowfall.
After intensive training, she sees differently.
All of the snowflakes produce this beautiful three-dimensional dance.
Berry's book is called Fixing My Gaze. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And we're back. Just before the break, we had a caller talking about her sister who had some, as she termed it, mental health issues, and she wondered what kinds of screening the prospective mother goes through before allowing this kind of implantation of egg or sperm to go forward. What's your reaction, Kimberly?
Well, many times what comes up in these conversations about reproductive technologies, whether we're talking about people with potential psychological issues or other kinds of older parents, et cetera, is whether or not there is a right to reproduce. And if one makes a fundamental commitment to that right, then I do think that there's a way in which a clinic could be aware, careful of health concerns, as Paul raised, but to make judgments about who can and cannot be a successful parent is, I think, outside of the clinic's jurisdiction. And it's important to note, and I'm, you know, of course, sympathetic to the caller, and I'm glad that she's giving so much support to her sister, but it's important to note that historically, people who are perceived to have a psychological or a cognitive disability have been forced to be sterilized, in fact, because of, and I'm not at all suggesting this was something something that the caller would endorse, but based on this idea that some people just shouldn't be allowed, we should lock them up, we should lock at least up their reproductive right. And I do think that that is a fundamentally ethical problematic thing to say.
Maureen, here's a question for you from Stuart in Cincinnati, who says, if the sperm donor was known by the woman to be deceased at the time of fertilization, it seems she had no expectation of his support in raising the child. Thus, the child needs no federal subsidy designed for that purpose. Your reaction?
And that's a great comment by Stuart. The purpose of Social Security survivorship benefits is to replace some income for the fact that the decedent can no longer work. When someone conceives a child posthumously, obviously they do so knowing that that person, the biological father usually, will not be around to support the child. Now, that's not to say, though, that on a blanket basis that no child that's conceived posthumously should be entitled to benefits, especially since the Social Security Act makes such benefits contingent on whether there's a legal parent-child relationship.
So what you're saying is that you are arguing in favor of a child receiving those Social Security benefits?
Yes. In my case, the child was conceived days after the decedent died.
I see.
So it was born literally within a year of the decedent's death, just as it would have been had it been conceived naturally. I do think there's instances where benefits should not be provided. For example, if a child is conceived many, many years after the decedent's death, then you have the issue of orderly administration of estates. You can't expect an estate to be kept open for 15 years pending a potential posthumous child. However, if you have a singleton birth or twins born within a reasonable period of time after the decedent's death, I do believe that the child should be considered an heir for intestacy purposes and for benefit purposes.
And what about if it were a frozen embryo? Would the same rules apply?
I think so. Whether it's cryopreserved sperm of the decedent or cryopreserved sperm that has been combined with an egg, it pretty much the same principles would apply. There has been an argument made that if there were embryos that were in existence prior to the decedent's death, that that would somehow elevate the claim, since the embryo, some people argue that life begins at conception. That's more of a religious argument. That is been an argument that's been made to elevate the entitlement to benefits, but it has not held muster.
All right, to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
And a long-time listener, I must say. Somebody kind of already answered my question about the rights of children of older deceased parents, but the more I listen to this, the more I'm a little concerned that it sounds more like people are ordering, and this is not all cases, but it seems more of a financial gain. Not so much people are worried about the children that are being made, it's all about the money. And that is, I have a high concern in, because it's designer babies. And I don't feel that people are concerned with the kids that are being made, they're more concerned with the financial background of it all. And I do have a concern with that, because I am a mother of two, and I've been to parks with my children, and I see more children being raised by nannies with older parents who are not in their lives, except for, you know, a couple hours at night and sometimes on the weekends. And I'm finding out a lot of these children are in vitros. And my concern is, you know, it just seems to me that these are more like pets than children, you know, like they're picking a specific type of pet and, oh, this is my child. And I'm wondering where the ethics comes in with this whole thing, you know, because I don't really hear anything about the children that are being made, more about the people who are buying the sperm and the embryos.
All right, Kim.
Well, like I said earlier in the discussion, I think children are born into all kinds of circumstances. I read a statistic recently where 1 in 4 unplanned pregnancies result in a child being born to a woman living in poverty. And that's a sad thing, I think. But we can't judge ahead of time the ways in which people should be or shouldn't be parents. I think we can have standards of care and concern about children, but the fact of a family arrangement having a woman who works and having a nanny doesn't in any way necessitate intervention. That can be as ethically good of a family dynamic as anything else. I do think one thing that could be raised from the caller's question is an issue that isn't brought up sufficiently, which is an issue of justice. And that is, as long as these kinds of technologies are not available equally for equal access and fairness to all people, namely through some kind of insurance plan, then these are alternatives that are only being sort of accessible to those who can afford it or who those who have generous insurance plans. And and interestingly, and Paul can maybe speak to this, infertility is not a problem of the rich. Many women who become infertile have become so because of bad medical care and poor health issues, pelvic inflammatory disease. These kinds of things can lead to infertility, and those women who have no financial access to any kind of IVF treatment are left out of the family-making options.
I want to ask you, Richard Vaughn, about the laws governing surrogacy. I gather that surrogacy is permitted in some states but not in others.
That's correct, Diane. In many states, the law simply doesn't address surrogacy. There are some states that do specifically address and allow it. There are other states that allow it but restrict it, for instance, restricting surrogacy to uncompensated surrogacy. But by and large, most of the states don't directly address surrogacy.
How many children are born each year that we know from surrogate parents, Richard?
I don't know that I would have an answer to that question.
Do
that
we?
That might be more appropriate for Dr. Gindoff.
Okay, Dr. Gindoff.
There's no database on that.
Is that because some people are not even keeping records?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But we also have to distinguish between traditional surrogacy and gestational surrogacy or gestational carrier host uterus. Of course, traditional surrogacy is simply inseminating a third individual woman, and she's pregnant, carries the child, and gives it up for adoption. Whereas gestational surrogacy is basically doing in vitro fertilization with the couple, the parent's sperm and egg, and then that resultant embryo is transferred back for implantation and pregnancy in the womb, the uterus of a third party, the gestational carrier. And the contract that needs to be codified ahead of time, obviously, is that the gestational carrier, who would legally be seen as the birth mother, needs to give the baby up for adoption to the genetic parents.
I see. Now, Richard Vaughn, do I understand that you and your partner used a surrogate?
Yes, we did, Diane. We have twin boys who are just now 2 years old.
Congratulations. And
thank you.
Did that involve a great deal of legal paperwork and a lot of legal advice?
It certainly did. In fact, there was basically a contract at every step of the way. We used an egg donor agency and a surrogacy agency, and there were contracts with them. There was a contract with the surrogate. There was a contract with the egg donor. And you sign informed consents at the IVF clinic as well. And then there are the court proceedings, not a contract, as you had just asked about, but a whole other mountain of paper to get into court and get the parental rights confirmed.
I see. All right. Let's go to Michael, who's in San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. I had a question for the OB doctor. I wanted to know, is work being done so that parents of the same sex can have a child? Maybe a woman could donate an egg and two men who were married could donate each a sperm and have a child that way?
Absolutely. It's called third-party reproduction. Basically, when you have in vitro fertilization, you need three components. You need sperm, egg, and a uterus. And the sperm or the egg and the uterus can come from different individuals.
Kim?
Yeah, there's been an interesting case, and maybe the lawyers can speak to this. I know a little about in Connecticut where a gay male couple used a gestational surrogate, and they didn't want to know which sperm from which man. They both contributed sperm to the creation of an embryo. They didn't want to know which one
actually
which
fathered.
One. Well, that the language gets complicated,
yeah,
but which gamete made its way in.
Yeah.
And why this was an interesting and complicated case was because Connecticut did use adoption as the model.
I see.
And so at the level of formality, what would happen is the gestational surrogate's name would be on the birth certificate, and the sperm owner's name would be on the birth certificate.
Huh.
And so, to legitimate that as a document, the state said, "Well, we're going to do a genetic test and find out who the father is."
I see.
The men fought this,
huh.
And from what I understand, the outcome, and it went through several layers of judicial decision making, but the outcome was that the two men are on the birth certificate, and that Connecticut did not use adoption as the vehicle
That's
for the establishment of parenthood. And so it was a very important case in our expanding our notions, Diane, of sort of what is a family. And what the law should be catching up with is not the technology, but it's with social change.
And Maureen McBrien, it makes me wonder to what extent laws are becoming more similar throughout states, because that's the question, isn't it? That if you go to one state, you're going to find one set of laws, another state, another set, which could complicate things that much more.
Right. You would think that would be the case, that the laws of the states are similar, or that there's a trend that certain laws would be enacted. But in fact, they're really all different. There's different models in different states. There's some laws on surrogacy in some states. There's no law in many states. What we do have is the Model Act governing assisted reproductive technology, which has been adopted by the American Bar Association in the beginning of 2008, which acts as model legislation for the respective state legislatures to consider in the event that they would like to enact statutes. But you'll find, by looking at all the laws, that a lot of this law just arises on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
So you have a particular fact-specific case that goes to a court and makes law that is distinct from all other cases that are decided by other states in some respects.
And
so that is what results in the differences.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think we have time for one last caller, Jason in Holt, Michigan. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment on the caller who essentially implied that this IVF procedures and so on is essentially a country club baby atmosphere. And I want to tell you that but for this technology, I don't know that I'd ever have had the opportunity to have my two beautiful twin boys that are 14 months old. They are a dream come true for me, and I will never, ever be more grateful for that dream, and I don't care how much it would have cost.
Well, congratulations, Jason. I'm glad it's worked so well.
I'd like to add something, Diane.
Sure.
That, a lot of people, I think, need to be aware of, that the children resulting from these processes are the most purposeful children. They are brought about by a lot of time, effort, money, a lot of professionals and people involved in helping make these family building dreams come true. And when these things work well, which is most of the time, they're beautiful, loving, and happy events.
And surely our last caller is representative of that feeling. And yet, Kim, it would seem that we do have some catching up to do.
Yes, I think so, Diana. I think that science and the technological practices that come from it give us opportunities to rethink. They give us opportunities to rethink what values we hold, what values we want to promote as a society. And rather than sort of worrying about the technologies themselves, for instance, like cloning, it in and of itself seemed like a bad thing to do. These issues about reproductive technologies aren't about the science. They're about our applications of them and how they change us.
Kimberly Layton, Richard Vaughn, Maureen McBryant, and Dr. Paul Gindorf. Fascinating discussion. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.